going up.
Prices keep going up these days. It feels like being on an elevator that only goes up.
Going up.
But not at Metro. We're pushing the down button.
Going down.
We've lowered prices and give you a 5-year price guarantee on talk, text, and data. Get one line of 5G data for $40, period. That's 20% lower. Only at Metro.
5-year guarantee on eligible plans. Exclusions apply. See website for details. Not available at Metro with T-Mobile in the past 6 months. Tax applies.
At Designer Shoe Warehouse, we believe that shoes are an important part of, well,
everything. From first steps to first dates, from all-nighters to all-time personal bests.
From building pillow forts to building a life.
For all the big and small moments that make up your whole world, DSW is there. And we've got just the shoes. Find a shoe for every you from brands you love at bragworthy prices at your DSW store or DSW.com.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to another edition of Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm your host, Chris Arnold of 105.3 The Fan. We start off today with Odyssey's series about pets. Everything you need to know.
Pets have not only had a big impact on many of our lives, but also our economy.
But why do we have pets? Why do we have just a select number and maybe a type of animal live with us inside our homes?
I'm David Rankin.
And I'm Kristen Diaz.
Join us as we explore the history and impact of the animals we call pets in this Odyssey conversation, Why We Have Pets.
Well, pet ownership is on the rise, fueling a multi-billion dollar industry. Everything from food to vet care, grooming, luxury service. But how does this impact consumers? Joining us is Chip Lupo. He's a writer and analyst at Wallet Hub to break down the latest pet industry trends and what they mean for our wallets. Chip, thanks so much for joining us.
That's my pleasure, Kristen. Thank you for having me.
Yes. You know, it's hard to drive down the street and not notice some luxury veterinarian services that have been popping up for animals and some luxury dog boarding facilities. It just seems like there's a whole new wave to the pet economy that is really surfacing. What are some of the pet industry trends that you've noticed?
Well, for starters, you're right, because there seems to be a lot of more high-end pet services out there. But that's that goes with the territory, because what we found is that in 2022, these are 2022 figures, Americans spent $136.8 billion on their pets. And that's just that's almost an 11% increase from the previous year. Now, pet spending has grown 50%+ from 2018 to 2022. What's interesting with those numbers, though, is that I'm wondering, because what happened between 2018 and 22, what happened right in the middle of there? We were locked down with COVID. So I'm wondering how much of this is related to the extra, because you're basically isolated from the rest of the world. How much time are you bonding with your pets during the lockdown?
The whole concept of what we will do for our pets has changed even over the last 40, 50 years. Think about it, is even just buying food. A lot of people just go to the grocery store, find what the latest can is on the shelves, and wouldn't think too much about it. Now, as Kristen has talked about, there's gourmet food. People are even going so far as to cook for their animals. What changed over the last 50 years?
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I'm a little anecdote here. A couple of years ago, my wife and I, we hosted, my wife was a missionary in Uganda 10 years ago, and we had some, and we hosted a Ugandan family for a couple of weeks while they were in the States. They were, to say the least, just shocked that the whole idea of pet, and we have five cats, And the idea of just pets indoors was just completely foreign to them, no pun intended. But it's interesting, though, where this trend in the pet ownership is, where it came from, actually, because it has risen from 56% in 1988 to almost two-thirds in 2024. Pet adoption, that's growing rapidly. But let's break down for a second here the cost while we're still on the subject. $58.1 billion on pet food and treats, $35.9 billion on veterinary care, $31.5 billion on supplies, live animals, and medications, and $11.4 billion on services. Now, this is the stuff like boarding, grooming, pet insurance, that's a thing now. Training, that's also a big thing now also.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there really hasn't been a particular reason that you guys have seen that spike?
No societal reason that I can think of, but it's interesting, though, if you break it down even further, because what we found is that younger pet owners, we're talking Gen Z and millennials, they spend more on their pets, but tend to worry more about the costs. And of course, older generations tend to prioritize just maintaining the care, taking your pets to vets regularly. And what I found interesting is that people will take better care of their pets than they will themselves. Mm-hmm. They would take their cat or their dog to the pet emergency hospital before they would go to their own doctor for a checkup.
There's also been a large boom in pet grooming, because that's become quite a big thing as well.
Yeah, pet grooming that's a big thing. And you were mentioning earlier, as far as boarding, it's no longer just bringing them in and just setting them in a kennel for a weekend. There's one in our area here in Columbia, South Carolina. It's a pet resort. Mm-hmm. You drop your pet off and with our cats, and they interact with other cats, and they have like their own little little dorm rooms. Yeah, it's come a long way. But again, some smart entrepreneurial figures out there took hold of this trend in our pets and are capitalizing it quite handsomely.
Yeah, I feel like over the years you've seen what was the basic need. Okay, bigger, box stores would handle all the things that you would need. You needed food, treats, maybe some equipment like a leash or a cat litter box, and perhaps they might also branch off. We saw, I remember over the 90s, like those same box stores then started incorporating vet services in them. And then now I feel like it's more the aesthetics, right? It's more, how can you make that experience more enjoyable? So it's not just about having a boarding facility. How do we make sure that they are getting VIP treatment? You have Wi-Fi, and there's a TV in the dog room and a little couch, and you can, Wi-Fi in if you have a login, so you can check on your dog while you're out of town. I mean, the level of comfort of being able to service the pet owner, even going to the vet. Can we offer you coffee or water while you're waiting for the vet? I mean, the whole vibe has changed, and customer service has really been, I feel like, at the top of that.
Interesting you bring it up, Kristen, because it's like if you're a parent and you're sending your kid off to camp for the first time.
Exactly.
Knowing that they're going to be in good hands and they're going to be taken care of, and you're not going to be calling every 5 minutes or wanting to know how your child's doing. It's that sort of same dynamic here. People are very attached to their pets, and they want to know that they're in good hands and they're going to be taken care of.
My point to that was just, with everything getting more and more expensive for our daily lives, humans I'm speaking of, how is it that pet owners are still, how have they adjusted their spending habits? Are they still willing to splurge on their pets for these types of things, for this customer service?
Apparently so, as long as you're getting good customer service. What I alluded to a second ago is that people will take their pet to the vet before they'll go to a doctor. So people are adjusting their own personal budget to be able to accommodate their pets in a lot of cases. People are maybe giving up a dinner once in a month to make sure their cats have the best food or the best bedding or the best toys.
And what's strange about it is you talk about the best toys is, in a lot of cases, you'll buy these expensive toys for a cat, and they're more interested in the box that it came in.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, that's a weird dynamic in our house too. It's just like, okay, look at this great box that I got. Well, meanwhile, the cat tree is sitting in the corner getting dust, but the box is just getting played with and slept in. And
yeah, it sounds like the treadmills at a lot of houses. Let's talk about something else. Is pet insurance has become a very hot topic lately, and the questions are, why are we taking out pet insurance, and are the pet insurance companies paying when people have claims?
Well, because this is sort of a new wave with pets, the insurance thing, you have to be careful, because in a lot of cases, you have to do your homework, because you know not all pet insurance policies are equal. And it's kind of like if you're looking at a home warranty or these car extended warranties, some are better than others. But for the most part, pet insurance don't seem to cover a whole lot. And you may have to pay, you know, it's like with health insurance. If you want extended coverage, you pay a little bit more. So you have to look at different tiers, look what's covered and what's not covered, consider the age of your cat, what kind of care they're going to need. But always do your homework and read the fine print when you're looking into pet insurance.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, financial planning for getting a pet is very crucial in the decision making on whether or not that's going to work for you or your family. And are we seeing people, you know, especially like you said, the spending on their pets? Are there certain industries that are growing that we're spending more money on? Maybe we're spending more money on vet care or on our pet insurance, or maybe we're spending more money on these luxury subscription boxes or anything of that sort?
Well, I think we're spending more across the board because of just the inflationary economy we're in. The people are looking at making sure that they get special foods. They're buying more high-end foods than they were. But then there's a lot more. It depends on whether you're a dog or a cat owner, whether you're going into for grooming and things like that, because our cats don't tend to go for that sort of thing. So, but yeah, people across the board are spending more and just, whether it's food or whether it's care, whether it's boarding, toys, it's spending more across the board.
I have one last question for you. Let's talk about a little bit about technology, because that has become a very big issue with a lot of people able to microchip their cats and their dogs in case they happen to go missing. How has technology improved a pet's life?
Well, it's improved a great deal because the technology, and that includes things such as tracking devices or monitors, and that's rising because, again, people are very much attached to their pets. And so a lot of times when a pet gets loose, it's really hard to track them down. Now, also things such as maybe even electric fences.
I was just about to say those geofences have gotten really popular too.
It's gotten real popular too. And it's funny because sometimes people don't believe you if you're walking through your neighborhood and the dog's approaching you and they're coming right at you. Sometimes you don't want to believe, oh, there's a, yeah, we've got an invisible fence there, but you still kind of react that way as you would when a dog charges at you.
My last question to you is just with that being said, with technology and the internet, is e-commerce outpacing brick and mortar stores, or are we seeing a comeback for certain retail space for animals specifically?
Well, I think it's swinging back towards your retailers. By retail, we're talking about not necessarily like your Walmarts, but pet specific stores like PetSmart or like Petco. I think you're seeing more of a swing back towards them. Now your online retailers were doing quite well during COVID, in fact, too well, because there were a lot of times when we were to order stuff and a lot of times things were out of stock. But I do think that people prefer to actually visit the big box stores, your retailers, because you're almost like you're part of a community. I think people will actually prefer to go to a pet retailer when you can get the same thing maybe for a few dollars less at just a regular retail store, just because you feel like you're part of a community. Even whether you're talking to the clerks or other customers, it just seems like it's more of a communal type relationship.
Yeah, in a lot of cases, you can bring your pets with you.
Oh yes, absolutely. Not just limited to service animals with some of these pet stores, but you do have to be careful though, because you get dogs and cats in the same room. Sometimes it's not a good situation.
Was there anything else you wanted our listeners to know just about how we're spending our money and on our pets?
Yeah, just a quick note on just annual pet expenses on average. What we found is that dog owners spend about $367 annually on vet care, $339 on food, and $99 on grooming. Cats, about $310 on food, a little less in vet care, and $50 on toys, which is good because that just it just means more boxes. We did find that Gen Z generations, they're more likely to splurge on things like pet birthdays and the specialized foods that we were talking about.
I think I understand that. I've probably been to some of those birthdays before.
Thrown those birthdays before.
Chip, thank you so much for your time and your insight. We really appreciate it.
Hey, Kristen, we appreciate it. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
You too. This is Why We Have Pets, an Odyssey Conversation produced by Dennis Foley.
You can listen to this show and this radio station anytime and anywhere across the country on the free Odyssey app.
I'm Kristen Diaz.
I'm David Rankin.
And that's Why We Have Pets.
Pets have not only had a big impact on many of our lives, but also our economy.
But why do we have pets? Why do we have just a select number and maybe a type of animal live with us inside our homes?
I'm David Rankin.
And I'm Kristen Diaz.
Join us as we explore the history and impact of the animals we call pets in this Odyssey Conversation, Why We Have Pets.
For almost as long as there have been people, there have been pets. Could be cats, dogs, birds, lizards, you name it. At last count, pets are in close to 87 million homes around the country. Dogs are in 68 million, cats right around 49 million homes. We take a look back at the history of pets and their people with Gregor Larson. He's a professor in the School of Archaeology at Oxford, and he joins us now. Gregor, thank you so much for the time.
Thanks for having me.
So as long as we've had pets, it kind of makes you wonder, who's the first person to say, you see that animal right there, I'm going to put a leash on it and keep it in a house. Why dogs? Why did early man turn to dogs?
You mean in order to...
To domesticate.
So right away, I'm not thinking that that's what happened. I'm not sure that anybody made that decision, or that we can ascribe that decision to any one person, because I don't think anybody did that. I think there was more of a mutualism that took place, where you had some wolves and you had some people, and they form a relationship quite accidentally. I don't know that anybody was intending to do this. And as a result of that, what happens is that you start to get an increasing closeness and an increasingly interdependence, which then turns into what we now know. And then we project what we have now onto the past and we wonder how it came to be. So my example for this is a colleague of mine recently left their phone at home before they came to work. And then they couldn't get into anything because it required this two-factor authentication, which required them to have their phone. Now, when phones first started coming into being, nobody imagined that if they left their personal phone device at home, that they wouldn't be able to work that day. Right? That's not how that worked. So or any relationship that you have, you meet somebody online in the supermarket, wherever else, and initially you're just kind of hanging out chatting, and then you realize that without that person, you couldn't do a whole range of other things, or they take over all the finances or whatever else, and you ascribe certain behaviors and activities to each other without ever intentionally deciding that it just sort of happens. And I think that that sort of just sort of happens thing is that's how you could very easily describe a lot of or all the relationships that people have had with as all the animals that you described and plants for that matter and a whole lot many more things too.
I think what happened was somebody fed somebody and they never went away.
You know, you're not.
I think any cat stray person can tell you that. Any stray dog person, that they gave them one little piece of food and then that animal never came and never stopped coming back.
Listen, you are absolutely right. I mean, there is a huge amount to be said for how feeding changes behavior, how feeding defines culture, and how feeding then changes interaction between two species and makes them interdependent upon one another. So if you start feeding someone, they're going to stay with you, you know, and all the phrases that we have, you know, a route to a man's heart is through his stomach is one, for example. Or if you want to change, I was watching an episode recently of a UK television program for kids called Sarah and Duck, and it's about a little girl and her relationship with this duck who says quack to everything. All the rest of the ducks in this episode start migrating south, and Duck feels like he needs to go to be with his friends, but Sarah feeds him, so he sticks around. Mm. And it's this whole thing, right? So it defines the relationship because you have that interdependence, and it means that Duck is no longer migrating, which is a real thing. We've demonstrated this all over the place. And so, yeah, I think dogs and feeding and food, and we have this with reindeer. People do this with salt licks, especially, and you can very easily manipulate an entire population of animals and get them to be what we might call more tame simply by saying, hey, you want some nutrition for free? Yes, of course we do.
You'll see on YouTube videos all the time of people. There's a guy in Russia that rescued a cougar, and that cougar lives in his house right now. Mm. You've seen some of the legendary ones where someone rescued a lion as a cub and brought it out, and he finally had to release it into the wild, but then the lion recognized him when they went on a safari.
Exactly. Yeah. And what's interesting there is that we get into this question of tameness. Like, are we talking about a development of a single individual where you, as a puppy or as a very young organism, you then learn this as a part of your development? Or is this a longer term multi-generational thing where you are born with a genetic inclination to make contact and with, you know, your eyes or your behavior, where you, it's perfectly acceptable then to be tame for a longer period of time? Because as you describe, a lot of things can be brought in as juveniles, but then they reach kind of mild adulthood or, you know, starting to go through maturity, and then they get a little rambunctious, and then you got to hit them on the head because they're going to eat your 3-year-old, and that's just not acceptable.
Can we talk also just, we know this conversation has been focused on the building that relationship, but can we also talk about the ideology and different cultures of pets? You know, I think of like the Egyptians, and you think of the Sphinx, or you think of the Asian culture, and how, you know, Shih Tzus were, you know, considered, you know, to be a royal pet, or things like that. I mean, it's pretty. And now in America, we have different dog shows. In the UK, we have the dog shows and the dynasty of these breeds. Can we talk a little bit about that as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, well, so you want to start with breeds, or you want to start with kind of just deep relationships, like the relationships that people have with individual animals?
I guess the relationship, and just there's some cultures really pride their, you know, their animals as part of being a luxury or part of their culture, versus others might think it's just an animal on the street. And I think there's a relationship difference between on how they actually perceive their animals to be.
You're absolutely right. And there's some really interesting stories and some data coming out about how dynamic that is and how changing that is and how that gets expressed culturally. So one of the stories I've heard recently, which I just think is absolutely fascinating, is that about naming, and the way in which you name something often describes or gives you an insight into the way that somebody feels about it. And there has been a real movement in the States. If you're even 100 years ago, you wouldn't really think to give your dog the name that you would give to your child. But that is increasingly so, right? I mean, I met a dog recently named Sean, and it's just funny, right? Because the dog's name is what you could call, I've got friends named Sean. I'm going to go see one for a drink later. So it's like, and so the way that that's playing out in South Asia right now is that there is this movement, especially amongst the middle classes, to sort of replicate the kind of relationship that is always depicted on in Hollywood and on screens of like a very American idea currently of a pet or an animal as something you keep in your house, you put in your photographs when you send out Christmas cards. They are effectively a member of your family. You mourn them when they die through the same kinds of death rituals that you would do with a family member. And so that kind of cultural attachment to an animal is now being replicated in South Asia, but the names that they give their dogs, because they are naming them now, because as you described, Kristen, a lot of people would not name kind of a street dog. They're bringing them into houses, so there's a shared space, they're naming them, but those dogs that they're naming, they're giving Western names to. So they will give them American or British names because it's part and parcel of an American or British tradition that they are emulating, but they would never give them an Indian name. And I think that's really telling, right? So you're allowed to have these relationships, but you're signifying that it's something that you're importing.
We had a cat when I was growing up, and we couldn't think of a name for her. And so we ended up calling her Kisa, which in Finnish means cat. So that ended up being her name. I had a question about the difference. What's the difference between a pet and a domesticated animal?
Yeah, I was going to ask you what you thought about that, because if this is like, why did you decide pets rather than just animals that we consider to be domestic that we rely upon for all kinds of other things? What was it in your head about pet?
My thinking of pet can be any animal that we've decided to include into our home, not necessarily what are considered domesticated. If you think about it, is how domesticated is a boa constrictor, but that can be considered a pet, correct?
Gotcha. Okay. So, but for you, the home is the thing. So it's that space where you are settled. You've got four walls, you've got rooms, and you're bringing them into that very, okay.
Well, I think that's also difficult. Like, we're in Texas, right? And a lot of people have ranches. And so, you know, some people have horses and donkeys they don't necessarily bring into their homes, but they're taking care of them. They're waking up at the crack of dawn. And are they considered pets? Oh, it's livestock. It just depends on where that fine line is. Are they going to sell that cow, or are they brushing and feeding him and loving him and he's going to stay on the farm forever? It depends, but I think most of us think of dogs, cats, like you said, maybe some reptiles in a cage that's in your kitchen.
But even a lot of people, if you're on those farms, a lot of people have working dogs, and those working dogs aren't allowed in the house very often, but are still. I was going to say, what is loved, right? Like, there's a whole generation in the UK of people, sort of my age-ish, whose parents just never told them they love them. Which is a weird kind of cultural thing. It's kind of shifted now, but it's amazing. We start talking about it now. It's like, oh no, it was weakness. My parents would never say that they love me, but they might say that about a pet. Like, and it's just because a pet, I think what we're signifying here is a closeness of a relationship, which demonstrates that you care about it beyond its just existence. Like you're motivated by it in a way, and you're incorporating it into your daily life. And maybe that's some kind of definition that we're working with. We're working on a study right now with a PhD student who's doing some amazing work where when we find in the archaeological record a whole individual that's been buried, if that is a canid or a felid, sort of a dog-like thing or wolf-like thing or a cat-like thing, we tend to immediately knee-jerk into this. And you see this in the literature. People go, oh, this is a signifier of a close relationship, so therefore it must be a domestic dog. It must be a domestic cat. So what we started doing was just doing a big survey of buried animals globally over 27,000 years. And what we started finding was that a whole lot of people all over the world bury things, but they bury animals that you and I would not really consider domestic. One of my favorites is in Peru, about 1400 AD, there is this platform which has been created. So it's kind of a terraformed space. And on that, there are three pelagic sharks that were buried as complete individuals. And as I excavate it, you can see the outlines of the sharks. There's no bones, of course, because it's all cartilage, but you can see all the teeth. And the teeth are arranged in all the rows that they were just placed there. And it's adjacent to a human cemetery. So it's clear that people had captured these things and buried them. Now, you wouldn't go that, oh, they've got domesticated sharks in Peru, right?
That's yeah.
Nor would we say, oh, that's a lovely pet shark that you have there. And yet they're treating them in death with a kind of personhood, with a sort of reverence, with a kind of respect that we ascribe to what we do with our pets. And I just there. So therefore, there is this fuzziness between what is that difference between pet and domestic, and how we interpret it, and how much of it is our current presumed relationships with the pets that we have in our house, with how people in the deep past were associating with other animals. And, you know, was that love? Was that a pet? Was that homage? What was that, like, something for the future? Who knows? But it was that same idea was there, that you've got something that's very important to you and you want to ascribe this thing with importance in death. And so you place it somewhere that has a significance that goes beyond something you might just eat and throw away.
To piggyback off of that, I think there's some conversations.
I'm sorry,
too.
To what, Kristen?
To piggyback off of what you were mentioning.
So are the piggies pets too?
All right.
Yeah. Ask George Clooney.
Do you have any specific research that you can remember about just how society handles the term pet and how over decades, like maybe like there have been more laws implemented or standards for like living situations, landlords, you know, allowing certain things to happen, communities becoming more pet friendly, maybe?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know of any specific studies on legislation. That tends to be more recent than the stuff that we look at. But I am aware that one of the big deals, and David, you mentioned it right at the top, was in houses, right? And a lot of people keep, and you do get into things like ethical things, like, is it okay to declaw your cat? Well, you're not going to declaw a cat unless it's living in your house. That has to be a prerequisite for that entire concept and the ethics around it to be considered. My understanding is that cats don't even come into houses until about the 1930s with the invention of kitty litter, because you can't have a cat in a house if you can't potty, you know, you can't potty train. You can take your dog out, but nobody's putting your cat on a lead. So the idea of a pet cat is also relative, that word, that pet being ascribed to a cat is, you know, barely a century old, because they were just kind of around. And so those kinds of things are really interesting, where we have this phenomenal change through time and a lot of recent dynamism in that shift. And I suspect a lot of that legislation is maybe already behind, but we'll be reflecting that as well.
Gregory Larson, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Why We Have Pets, an Odyssey conversation produced by Dennis Foley.
You can listen to this show and this radio station anytime and anywhere across the country on the free Odyssey app.
I'm Kristen Diaz.
I'm David Rankin.
And that's Why We Have Pets.
Avoiding your unfinished home projects because you're not sure where to start? Thumbtack knows homes, so you don't have to. Don't know the difference between matte paint finish and satin? Or what that clunking sound from your dryer is? With Thumbtack, you don't have to be a home pro. You just have to hire one. You can hire top-rated pros, see price estimates, and read reviews, all on the app. Download today.
Nerds! Today's episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. Smart Travel doesn't just cover points and miles. They break down all the financial aspects of your trip, whether that's the best days to book, how to avoid hidden fees, or which fancy travel credit cards pay off, and which ones are just an expensive flex. If you want your travel budget to work harder, then dive into the best deals, products, services, and more with Smart Travel from NerdWallet, wherever you get your podcasts.
Every morning brings a fresh new energy.
This is Today with
Zoe. And no matter what the day holds, we come to the Today Show for all of it.
When things are tough, we talk about it. When there's something to figure out, we dig into it. And when there's joy, we celebrate it.
Because today is where it's all happening. We get the best start to every morning because we start it together.
Watch the Today Show with Savannah Guthrie and Craig Melvin weekdays at 7 a.m. on NBC.
And joining us now is the founder and executive director of Top Achievers, a North Texas nonprofit that invests in student success after high school. Providing with scholarships and resources, the knowledge to get to college and beyond, is Mr. Lawrence Mann. How you doing, Lawrence?
I am doing fine, Chris. How about yourself, my brother?
I'm always good talking to you because, again, you and I have been knowing each other a long, long time, and your Top Achievers nonprofit has been successful. And it continues to grow and grow and grow. You guys have been around in the North Texas Plano area since 1996, right?
That's correct, 1996.
Please tell all of our listeners how you started this thing, because the story is simply amazing.
Oh, well, man, first of all, thank you for allowing me to express my feelings on your podcast. Mm-hmm. And thank you for our friendship for many years. And I appreciate it with a humble spirit. So I started at Top Achievers 1996 when my oldest son at the time was 5 years old, Chris, had an open heart surgery. And the doctors, they told me, you know, your son was born with a ventricular septal heart defect and the hole was enlarged and we need to go in and close it and put a Gore-Tex patch over the hole to keep the blood from leaking through the valve. And I'm thinking like, what are y'all talking about? So they say, yeah, and it's a 50-50 chance that he may survive this operation. And Chris, being a native Detroiter, and being raised in the Motor City, a lot of things going on in my life, right? Mm-hmm. We saw so many moving parts just to survive. But I remember my mom telling me this before I came to Texas to attend school at SMU with my brother, Terrence Mann. She said, "Hey, guys, life is going to hit you sometimes."
Yeah.
And she said, "Because it's called life. And when it does hit you, you're going to feel like you're in a white box with no doors, no windows, and no way out. But at that time, you make a vow to God, but don't break the vow. And he's going to deliver you whatever you're going through." And so I never made a vow to God until that time. I saw my son on the, you know, in the operating room, mm-hmm. with tubes in his throat, tubes in his chest. And the doctor said, "We're going to make it." I'm like, "Okay, my doctor is greater than the doctors they have on earth. But God, let me tell you something. As an act of faith, I'm going to quit my job while I was in the hospital, and I'm going to dedicate my life to kids and health and fitness if you bring my son back to his normal state." And so I quit my job, Chris, while I was in the hospital, man, working for Western Union as an accountant. And I said, "I'm not coming back." And they said, "Well, what you going to do?" I'm like, "I don't know. But whatever I do is going to be working with kids and helping them become successful in life." And so at that time, I prayed to God and said, "Okay, deliver them." 48 hours later, the doctor say, "Look, we're going to come in, take the tubes out, and we're going to cut the all the machines out." At that time, he was on a lung bypass machine and a heart bypass machine. They say, "After we take it out, we don't know all we can do." And at that time, my wife and I would continue to pray. And it was funny, Chris, right before he went under the knife, mm-hmm. I remember having all these great talks with my son. "Son, you're going to make it. You know, you're going to be all right." I'm feeling his chest, right? Saying, "Okay, that scar that's going to be in your chest, that's going to be a battle scar for mm-hmm. life. You're going to be okay, my brother." And I say, "And Dad's going to get you anything you want after this operation. You tell me what you want." He goes, "Dad, I want me a Sega Genesis game." I said, "Son, you got it.
Yeah.
Let's go through this."
Yeah.
And I'm saying, I didn't have, you know, the resources to get it at that time, but I'm like, "I'm scraping that game up, man. He will get a Sega Genesis.
You're going to find a way."
I'm going to find a way, my brother. So to fast forward, a week later, you know, he goes under the knife. They said, "Mr. Mann, okay, it's time to take him off the machines." And my wife and I praying because we didn't see his eyes open. From the time they put him under for a week and a half, his eyes were shut. Mm. And so we were just so grateful to be able to see him breathe again on his own and open his eyes to see that smile. So when they took him off the machines, about an hour later, they say he's going to come, you know, if he's going to make it, he's going to start talking a little bit. He's going to open his eyes. And you guys can point to these map. We're going to give you a little map, and we're going to give you some illustrations of ice as food, cold, warm. Because if he's cold, you can point to the piece of paper, and he can nod his head yes or no, because he couldn't talk because his vocal cords were, mm-hmm. It had collapsed. Plus they had the tubes in his throat. And so I remember my son opening his eyes, and my wife and I looked at each other like, "Baby, open his eyes." And then he was trying to talk to us. His lips started moving, Chris. So we put Vaseline on the lips because it was so chapped from mm-hmm. 2 weeks, man. But then he's trying to say something, man. And so he was trying to speak, but there was no vocal coming out, no words coming out. But I put my ears to his mouth. I said, "What's going on? You're hungry?" He nodded his head, "No." I said, "You're cold?" He nodded it, "No." I said, "What do you want? What are you trying to say?" He go, "Sega. Sega."
You said, "This guy," you said, "my son's mind is still sharp as a tack."
Oh my goodness. I'm like, "We're going to the store and get that right now." And I'm telling you, man, he was so excited. And I'm telling you, 3 hours later, man, he was just up and normal again. So it was a blessing. And he's 30, 37 years old now, have three kids. I'm working with my grandson. I'm coaching my grandson. And I just kind of laugh a little bit, say, wow, this is pretty cool. So that was the beginning of Top Achievers, man. And I left the hospital and I'm drawing. Mm-hmm. I'm drawing out what I'm going to do next. And I remember this because of we had to wait 48 hours after they took the tubes out. I'm in the ICU unit and I'm drawing a mountain. Because I just couldn't think about what I'm going to do. But I was like, okay, God, what are we going to do here? I just quit my job. And I drew a mountain because to me, mountains are, it's angelic. It's inspirational. Mm-hmm. It's a sign of power, strength. And so I drew a mountain. Then I drew a stick figure of a man on top of the mountain raising his hand. Now the hand movement and the arm movement was of Muhammad Ali when he came back after he had been kicked out and went to jail mm-hmm. for not going to war. He came back to fight Joe Frazier
mm-hmm.
and to win his championship. He put his hands up in the air and said, I'm the greatest. So when you look at my logo, it's of a stick figure of a running man, hands up in the air on a mountain, because I thought about the mountain because Martin Luther King said, I've been to the mountaintop. I didn't see anything.
Yes.
So all this was going through my head, man. And my logo represent Martin Luther King's speech. I've been to the mountaintop, and Martin Luther King was one of my inspirational figures in life. And then Muhammad Ali, of course, who have said, you know what? I've been down, but I'm coming back.
That's right. So, the greatest of all time.
Yes, that's just
why people say the GOAT. When they say GOAT, it's Muhammad Ali was the first to say, I'm the greatest of all time.
Yes, that's correct.
He put that pressure on himself to achieve.
Yes, yes. So my wife said, what are we going to do, baby? I'm like, I'm going to do something. And I had a business, you know, I had some things in sales. Mm-hmm. I had some sales experience. So Rod Jones, who played with the Cincinnati Bengals, he was just a good friend of mine. Mm-hmm. And Rod,
I remember Rod.
Yeah, Rob was just, I got him in some investments.
He was a cornerback, wasn't he?
Yep, that's right. Mm-hmm. He was a cornerback. And I say, Rod, I'll go and work for you free, man, and help you build your business. He said, why you want to do it free? I said, because I have a plan. I have a plan. I said, if you allow me to build a kid's business in your health clubs, and there's no conflict of interest, I'll help bring your club to a status where you'll be proud and you guys can become profitable. And so that was the agreement, man. And Rod gave me the facilities to get started working out kids.
This is it's an amazing story. And again, that's when you pledge the rest of your life to invest in youth. This started in 1996, like you mentioned, and this after school education and coaching program. You guys are into STEAM, esports, financial literacy, basketball, as well as mentorships from area leaders, top achievers, preparing students for success in college and beyond. At that time, did you know it would grow to be this big? And again, you're still not where you probably want to be, but this is impressive after decades and decades of doing this.
Yes, you know, and that's when you look at life, man, it all evolves, you mm-hmm. know, and you have a mission. You have a mission in life. You say, okay, am I just going to have a goal and a mission, or am I going to continue to evolve into something special? Because when you look at the world and the way kids are forming, you have to be creative on how you approach these kids.
Right.
And again, about sports. So we come in from a holistic standpoint, right? I knew, you know, that a kid needs education. I know a kid wants to get faster and stronger, you know, so we're going to provide, you know, the speed development, because I used a lot of my guys like Mark Aguirre for basketball mm-hmm. training back in the day. I used guys like Moreland Wiley, who still works with me today.
Mm-hmm.
Rod Jones did my speed development. So I asked my plethora of networking friends, said, look, man, I need you guys to help shape these kids, because we all was in the same boat. We knew we needed all these skill sets. So let's go ahead and provide these services for the kids. So even when I came to Plano and literally went door to door to tell people what we're going to build, because I didn't have anything. I was using racquetball courts just to run the program, Chris. Mm-hmm. And so West Plano was building up, and I just went to some folks and said, look, we're going to build a health club for kids. We're going to help save lives through academic success, through science, technology, engineering, arts, and math, and through basketball training. And so they were like, really? How do we sign up? And that was the beginning. People were coming through the doors. And I didn't have any strong capital to build this facility, that first facility. I didn't have the strong capital, but it's through faith, through the passion. People believe in me. We raised $60,000 in 1 month wow. to open the doors of our own facility.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very impressive what you're doing. And again, it's allowing kids to get scholarships, especially the economically disadvantaged youth, because, you know, every kid deserves a chance. With that being said, I'm sure you're thinking, okay, hopefully we can provide these scholarships and kids can get these, you know, educations through colleges and universities. But I see that you've got a 95% graduation rate, or put it like this, 95% of the students go on to attend college. How did you know that that number would even happen? Because obviously the kids are invested and you got kids from all over.
Well, you know what, man, being a native Detroiter and looking at a grind, you know, we could have gone either way in Detroit. Either, you know, you got the Motown sound. So if you were a singer, mm-hmm. you can go that route.
Mm-hmm.
If you're an athlete, you can go that route. But then it was the drugs. It was mm-hmm. drugs and gangs that was plaguing us, right? You can go that route as well. And I knew that I wanted to be in an environment where I saw successful people. And so when I saw the Stokely Carmichaels coming to our campus and give empowerment speeches, when I saw Jesse Jackson, I'm like, these brothers giving out some strong messages. And I was like, you know what? I have a few friends that we're connected with right now, and we're doing the same thing because we thrive off of each other. Mm-hmm. And I got some guys that were not in school, but they were driving Mercedes-Benzes and, you know, having the fine linen clothes, man. And I knew they was hustling the wrong way. So when I started putting together our program, I said, let me build a culture where people can come in and they can achieve their goals in the sports, but not only achieve sports, let's help them academically, let's help them socially, emotionally, and let's provide services that will give kids a chance. And if we are creatures of habit, and if you put a kid in an environment where they're successful people, then most likely that's going to create a culture where everybody wants to do the same thing. That's first step is to graduate. So that was pretty cool. And mm-hmm. I'm telling you, I put in 95%, but it's probably more like 98 to 100%. I mean, I don't remember a kid coming through our program that didn't graduate from mm-hmm. high school.
Mm-hmm.
And then, 90% of those kids went on to college. Mostly all of our kids have graduated and went on to college because that was something that we were expecting, and you inspect what you expect. So we used to put together, again, basketball programs, but I started looking at other cultures to see why they were successful, because in Top Achievers, it was a good cultural mix of kids.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just the economics.
Exactly.
And I knew that.
Because you know, steel sharpens steel, iron sharpens iron.
There you go. There you go.
You mix everybody in together, and guess what? Different traits and different things that they're interested in, other kids find out, wow, you know what? I like that too. Or I can learn how to do that as well.
That's right, Chris. And I remember my oldest son, Lawrence, who the one that I started the whole program mm-hmm. with, when he was in seventh grade, he was at a school in Plano, and he brought home his report card and he said, Dad, look, I made the honor roll list. And I'm like, okay, what did that mean? I'm thinking, okay, what did that mean? What does that mean? You're a minority, but you made the honor roll list. So I'm looking at the back of this honor roll list, and it had names like Ming, Mong, then he had Man. I'm like, okay, this is speaking to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to my Asian community and said, look, what are y'all doing? Because I see a whole list mm-hmm. of my Asians doing very well academically, especially in the math. They go, Mr. Man, we go to Chinese school on weekends. I'm like, ah. And I remember this, Chris. I called the Chinese school they were going to, and I asked the professor, what are you charging for your math program? He says, $250 an hour. I said, huh? He goes, $250, $250 an hour. I said, all right. I said, I'm saying to myself, I know our kids can't afford that. Our families can't afford that. That's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but he was getting some great measurable outcomes.
Right.
I'm always the kind of guy like, if they can do it, I can do it as well. So I asked him, I said, look, I want to book you. I want to book you for 3 months. And you can come in on Thursdays for 2 hours and we'll pay you $250 an hour. Mm-hmm. So I went to my community and I told all my players, my basketball players and their families, I need 150 from you. I need 150 from you. Mm-hmm. Boom, boom, boom. So I gathered all this money up.
Mm-hmm.
I had the contract with them. I faxed over the contract and he said 250 an hour. And when he came to our first class, I had 20 people in that classroom. I didn't disclose. He didn't disclose only one person per hour.
Right.
So I
filled up. Exactly. You said, let me maximize this and let me get this. Let me get this whole classroom full because he's saying the same things. It's just not one on one.
There you go.
Yeah. That's maximizing it. That's calling being efficient with it.
Yes. And I start seeing our kids having fun, learning the techniques, learning the strategies.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time they were in 10th grade, they were all college qualifiers.
That's
awesome. And there's a brother, there's a young man that you probably know best, and I'm going to say his name because he's just a dear friend of mine because he witnessed all this. He worked with the Mavericks for over 20 years. He was a CFO, former CFO, Floyd Yonner.
Floyd, yep. Floyd's awesome. Yep, he's an awesome guy.
So Floyd was, he rode that bus with me. He saw the measurable outcomes, and he still is an advisor today because he saw that it worked.
You know what's so wild? And we're talking with Lawrence Mann. He is the founder and executive director of Top Achievers, this program that inspires and helps youth get scholarships and extend their education. And the thing that's so impressive about what you're doing, again, most, if not all of them graduate high school and 90% or better go off to college. Some of the colleges they go to, not just the different colleges in the state of Texas, not just HBCUs, you've got some that went to Harvard.
Yes. Harvard, Cornell, Colgate,
yeah.
MIT. I mean, it's amazing.
MIT.
Yeah, you put the kids in a good environment, they thrive, man. And you know what? You know, I worked for Plano ISD during the day as a counselor, and my role was an at-risk specialist years ago. And they asked me, the kids, like, Coach, man, am I at risk? I'm like, dude, we all at risk.
Exactly.
Turn the TV on right now.
For real.
Turn it on right now.
Yep.
You're going to see politicians. You're going to see movie stars. You're going to see singers.
Lots of people. If you breathe, you're at risk.
Right, right. So, again, we want to create an environment where it's a holistic environment where they can have fun. Learning is fun. And then the friendly competition. You know, when we were back in the hood, right, we would always say, what schools want to go to? What schools we didn't want to go to? But you speak words into existence.
Right, right.
You know, and someone asked me this question. Well, Mr. Mann, it was years ago. When did you start mentoring? And I had to reflect and go back to probably my first time going to camp. I was looking for a job when I was 17 years old, scouring around Detroit. And this young man, I saw this big cathedral, man. And so I walked into this big church cathedral and I was like, look, I'll clean up. I'll do anything, man. I just want to make some money. And this guy says, well, have you ever been a camp counselor before? I'm like, camp counselor, what's that? I never heard of a camp counselor. I've never been to camp.
Right.
And so the director came down to talk to me and he says, look, you're going to be up north of Michigan for about 2 months and we'll pay you for the whole summer. I think it was like $1,500. And here's your list of kids and all you have to do is mentor. And I believe that you can do this. And my first set of kids, right, I remember going to the campus, and they gave me a list of kids, Chris. And one of my campers came to me. He go, Mr. Counselor, they're fussing at me. These kids are making fun of me, and they and they're talking about me and my family. And I'm like, come here, son. I said, it's going to be okay. You know, you're with me right now. And so I said, what are they saying? What I'm saying, my grandfather is buried under Giant Stadium.
What? Jimmy Hoffa.
Jimmy Hoffa.
Oh, my goodness.
It was his grandkids. Jeff and Mark Hoffa was my first time. And that story.
He was the president of the Teamsters Union back in the day.
There you go. There you go. And so when I watched the movie The Irishman, oh my gosh. And it was one part of the movie where it said he needs to, he's beyond himself. He needs to go back and raise his grandkids, be with his grandkids. It just all went back
to
79, 78, 79, when I was taking care of his grandkids up in Camp Westminster.
You never know who somebody is and who their family are. You just never
But that
know.
Was my time. That was the first time I really actively mentor a young man and helped him feel empowered when people were bullying him and calling his name. So that's special to me.
You know what? You've got amazing stories. And like I said, you're here in North Texas. You went to school at SMU, your brother T-Man, Terrence Mann. With that being said, the fact that you've been able to partner with so many quality organizations with the top achievers, that says something about you too, but it also says something about your program. And I remember you were saying last week, you were talking and you were saying that a lot of different people will believe in what you're doing nowadays when you can show them the numbers. They're into the analytics. You know, technology is big with analytics, and we want to know the data that proves that you're doing what you say you're doing. And your website is just loaded with all of the information, the facts and the figures of these top achievers actually achieving and getting things done. Can you talk about where you realize that was part of the equation, that you had to back it up and show a lot of different corporations and individuals the numbers?
Yeah, you know, as you start scaling your organization and I'm just in the grind, just trying to get these measurable outcomes and get these kids where they need to be. And as you start getting, you're asking for more funding to help people, like, okay, we can see it, but give us the data.
Yeah.
So I remember going back in 2006, I went through Facebook, I went through Instagram, I took 200 names of where they're now, all of my kids that come through, top achiever. And it wasn't all, this was just 200 names of where I can prove where these kids were. And out of that 200, that's where I got that big stat. 95% of those kids went off to college. I emailed them, where are you? Got their college, and then I got their graduation rate. And so I said, wow, this is speaking to me. This is really, really cool. We're doing something unique here, not just serving snacks and telling them bye, bye, bye. We are building a culture where kids have an expectations to do something great beyond, you know, beyond their sports. And one of the things that we started with a few years ago, there was two kids from our basketball team didn't want to go further and to play basketball. So I said, look, what about trade school? So one of my board members have said that it was a free program in Blairsville, Pennsylvania, that were offering kids scholarship to learn a trade. You're down there, you go up there for six to 9 months, come back with certificates, and they will get you a job working in the industry which you want to be a part of. And so there was a young man, I'm going to say the name, he's a great kid, named Rashawn Miller from Plano, took my advice, shipped him up to Blairsville, Pennsylvania. He went to this training for 9 months, came back, and now the brother's working at a Lexus dealership off of 121 and Plano Parkway area. And so that was cool to me because everybody's not cut from the cloth to go to college, right? There's a lot of different talent and kids and areas, and we need the trades. So
exactly.
Technical trades, man. If there's a kid that want to go down that path, we're looking for individuals. We're looking for entities and companies to say, look, we got some for that kid. You vet the kid, and we will bring them to our program. And that's important too, Chris, is to get them prepared, because the first time that I had, I sent the kid to Blairsville, Pennsylvania, he came back, he was excited, and I got him connected to another dealership and they liked him, but he didn't fare well in the interviewing process. And so they denied him.
Yeah.
So You know, so I said, okay, man, let's do this. We're going to prepare you for 3 months before you go out there.
There you go.
So we prepared this kid, and now he's in a dealership where he's thriving. And the manager of the dealership saying this dude is, they haven't had any students like him before. And he's just excelling very well. So that's a great story for us, man, is to take kids at any level, take where they're at. But again, I use the acronym AED to describe what we're doing in Top Achievers. A, we assess a kid's talent. We can find that talent through STEAM, science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. We can find it in financial literacy. We can find it in sports. We can find it in mentorship. Once we find that talent, we E, give them some exposure in those areas. And this is where our network comes in. And I make these recommendations based on vetting the kid and getting them prepared for the real world. And so once they get that exposure in these internships, D, they'll have a direction where to go. And so that's what we want to do, help connect them with a direction once they leave, you know, they leave school and they're on their own.
It's absolutely amazing what you've been able to accomplish, and it continues to grow. We're going to definitely have to have you back on to talk some more because we're just scratching the surface. Is there a location, you can say the website or on social media, where people can find out more about the Top Achievers? And also this, how did you come up with the name Top Achievers? Because I think it inspires kids who are in the program because they say, hey, I'm a top achiever.
Yes. Well, that mountaintop story, that was for real. When I drew the mountaintop, I said, okay, I've been to the top of that mountain. And then I drew the running man on top of the mountain and said he's going to achieve all these goals. And thinking about Muhammad Ali, what he achieved in his life. So Top Achievers came from those drawings. And you can find us. We have an app, Top Achievers. Just go to your Apple Play Store or your Google Play Store. Download Top Achievers. You'll get the app and you'll have updates on all of the programs for the whole year that we have on our calendar of events. And so we like to get more kids involved. We're going to be offering free math tutorials from UTD's professors. And we want to, you know, we have one location right now in Plano, but we want to scale next year till we got about 15 locations in the Collin County area where we can take our kids, build a culture where they go to school on Saturdays. We feed them. They learn this advanced math, the learning math that they're working on in schools, and to help them achieve some of those goals, whether it's analytics, whether it's being a statistician, whether it's being in sports, whatever. We want to just provide opportunities with our plethora of networking friends.
Lawrence, it's been a pleasure. Thank you for joining us, and thank you all for joining us on Better Living, a show about people or organizations having a big impact here in North Texas. I'm Chris Arnold. So long, everybody.